Chapter 25. Sometimes I wish you'd say something, said Heraldin, advancing a bannerman. Geist's only reply was to advance a knight. Suddenly Heraldin found his last piece under a dual threat. I suppose I should count my blessings, said the bard with a grimace. He knocked over his king, conceding the match. If you spoke right now, I'm sure you'd be intolerably smug. The weapons master's eyes conveyed sufficient smugness without the benefit of spoken words. Yes, fine, you win again, said Heraldin, moving the throne's pieces back into place. The weapons master tapped the table and nodded at the surrounding space. The tavern's common room had emptied by this hour, and even the barkeep had shuffled off to bed. The only other occupant of the room was a wrinkled slaw, pushing a mop along with short hops. I know the hour is late, said the bard, but stay for one more game, my friend. I want to show you something. Geist shrugged and set up his own pieces. Heraldin started the game with the Northerner's Gambit, a well-known opener from the Edelmann school. Geist countered with the Lion's Ruse, regarded as one of the best counters to any number of openers. The Game of Thrones continued in a familiar way, following patterns they'd played through many times. Then Heraldin moved his king into the path of Geist's queen. The stoic man smirked a little as he took the bard's piece. Heraldin shrugged as he swapped the fallen king with one of his paladins still on the board. The bard had often surmised that the mechanic of allowing a king to be succeeded by another piece of sufficient rank was why the game was called Thrones and not Throne. With his new king in place, Heraldin immediately moved it into range of Geist's knight. Geist scowled at the board. His eyes darted back and forth over the pieces, clearly searching for a ruse. Seeing none, he cautiously took the bard's king again. Heraldin promoted his last paladin and immediately charged it into danger. Now Geist was glaring at him, annoyance flashing in his dark eyes. Is something wrong? The bard asked innocently. The huge man pointed a finger at the king. Yes? What? The weapons master narrowed his eyes at the bard. Are you implying that I've given up? Said Heraldin with mock indignation. Geist nodded once. That I'm throwing everything away too early? That I've abandoned the good possibilities in exchange for a foolish sacrifice? Heraldin pressed. Geist was still staring at the bard through slits. Yes, now you see my point, said the bard. But will you remember it this time? I don't want you to die for me. And if this Eheen the Red was worth half the loyalty you've shown him, he wouldn't want you to die for him either. We want you to live, my friend. And if you want to honor him or to help me, you must want to live as well. Geist sat motionless, but Heraldin had learned to look closer. There was a barely perceptible tightening around the mouth beneath the weapons master's crimson scarf, a tensing of the muscles around the eyes that brought the doppelganger's harsh stare closer to an introspective squint. A faint motion, more of a hint of a nod than an actual affirmation. It wasn't much, but Heraldin smiled anyway as he picked up the pieces. It was the answer he had expected. No response? Gorm trundled down the path on the gravelly slopes. Caitha turned to him as he approached, a small and weary smile on her face. The patchwork farmlands west of Andoran spread out behind her as far as the eye could see. Dawn's light was creeping around the edges of the landscape, but Mount Windspar still shadowed much of the view. None, Caitha said, turning back to look out over the farmland. How long have you been out here? He asked, sitting down beside her. The elf rubbed at the bags beneath her eyes. A few hours before dawn. I thought he might come when it's dark. I see you've set out the customary offering for the king in the wood. Gorm pointed at a rock a short distance away, topped with purple trinkets piled on a lavender handkerchief. Caitha shrugged. I just wanted him to know, to see why I'm out here.
Makes sense, said Gorm.
For a time they sat and watched the sunlight draw long shadows over the land. Gorm scratched his beard thoughtfully.
You know that if we had any idea where he is...
We don't, said Caitha in a small voice.
All I'm saying is, if we did...
I've searched everywhere. We've asked everyone. The elf shook her head. I can't find any sign of him, and if we're going to stop Datar, we can't wait for him.
I know, said Gorm. They continued to watch the amber sunlight creep over the golden-green fields of early spring.
We're bound to find signs of Thane at some point, and you can be sure that when we do, we'll go after him as fast as we can. And when we find him, you can... you know.
I really don't know. The elf shook her head with a bitter laugh. I mean, I had all these dreams of what it would be like when I met the king in the wood, but they were... I mean, he was different in them, obviously. A troll? I don't know what you would... I mean, how can you relate? How would that work?
Gorm just shook his head and tried very hard not to think about it.
But I don't know that I couldn't either, Caitha added. We had a real connection. I could feel it, Gorm. I could feel him.
I know. We all saw it. Gorm suppressed a shudder.
Besides, most men I've encountered buy you a drink and some cheap food, and they expect you to... You know.
Say no more, said Gorm, and meant it.
But Thane? I mean, he left his home for me. He saved us more times than I can count, and he's never asked for anything. You look your whole life for someone that devoted, and that's saying something for my people. So when the chance at whatever this could be comes along, I have to take it. But instead, I shot him in the face. Now I just... I can't...
Not exactly how you want to leave things with him, said Gorm.
Yeah. Caitha's hands balled into fists. Or start things with him.
I put my axe in his face a couple of times when we first met, and we still became fast friends, he said.
That's nothing, said Caitha. Thane followed me from the shadows for months, and I was a fool who fancied him some sort of ancient king. And then he saved me from wandering in the wilderness while in withdrawal, brought me back to the party, and killed an assassin who wanted to slit my throat. And to thank him, I put an arrow through his eye.
It is quite a bit of history to get past when you put it like that, Gorm acknowledged.
Caitha smirked and wiped her eyes. It's hard to imagine a more dysfunctional relationship.
Gorm looked back over his shoulder at the tiny inn sitting in Mount Windspar's shadow by the side of the Terrapin River.
Oh, not too hard, he said.
Laruna wasn't glaring at Jin. He knew that she wasn't, because she had been avoiding looking at him for 3 days now. She looked past him, spoke over him, undermined him, and found myriad other ways to circumnavigate their relationship without crossing his path. Her frosty silence reminded him of when they first met, he noted wistfully. Yet Laruna's demeanor was a bit different now. She was definitely not glaring at him, per se, but she was leveling a burning stare at the air just over his left shoulder, as though menacing the rafters behind him.
There isn't another table, she remarked to no one in particular, and gestured at the tiny common room of the tavern.
The River Otter was an unusual establishment, set on the edge of a small hamlet just outside the River Downs. By most standards, it wasn't an inn at all. The bedrooms were scattered throughout the working farm behind the tavern. For a fee, heroes and mercenaries could bed down in an old barn, find a quiet corner of the loft, roost with the chickens, or rent a private tool shed. It was far from luxurious, but for a certain patronage, secrecy was the only important amenity, and the Otter offered that in spades. The differences between a night at the Otter and a night sneaking into a farmer's loft were discretion and a surprisingly hefty bill slipped under the doorway.
I'm aware, Jin set his breakfast of bread and cheese down at the edge of the table next to Bert. That's why I'm sitting at this one.
I think it would be polite to let others finish eating before disrupting their meal, Laruna insisted to the ceiling.
And I think it's ridiculous, said Jin, that you cannot eat with an omnimancer. But that is your own concern. I won't be bothered by it.
It isn't that, she hissed.
The Solomancer's flash of anger melted her resolve not to make eye contact, and she stared at him with eyes like embers.
I just have a problem eating with liars.
You're eating with Haraldin, Jin said.
Leave the bard out of this, Laruna snapped.
No, no, said Haraldin through a mouthful of eggs. That's a fair point.
I meant bigger lies than that, said Laruna.
She shifted her eyes back to the rafters. lies about who you truly are.
We're here with a doppelganger, said Jin. No offense. Geist shrugged.
I don't want to be near your kind of sniveling mongrel,
Laruna sputtered at the ceiling.
Bert pointed a claw at Jin. Let me stop you before you go there.
I wasn't going there. The Omnimancer put his hands in the air.
You're thrice cursed right you weren't.
Bert snorted and turned back to his breakfast.
Didn't the wizard save your life? Heraldin asked the mage. And I appreciate that, said Laruna carefully. But the fact remains that he wouldn't have needed to if he had been honest about what he was. How much different could the fight with Dutar have been with an Omnimancer wielding the staff?
Jin shrugged off the accusation. My entire life is a series of events that could have been great if they went another way. What if Mother didn't die? What if Father's research had been successful? What if my marriage to Marja had kept Father alive? What if the Almatrans never recruited me? What if you and I had done things differently?
He dismissed these alternative realities with a wave of his hand. We could spend an age wondering about the things that could have been.
None of them will be. It's best to set such feelings aside and focus on the work at hand.
The Solomancer finally looked at him again, albeit with the same face she might have used if he had grown a tentacle from his ear. You really can dismiss your feelings that easily, can't you?
I already have, said Jin. There is a job to be done.
Then you and I are just, what, colleagues?
Professional acquaintances, if you prefer.
The heat and fury seemed to drain out of the Solomancer's face, leaving a small, tight smile. As you'd have it, she said coldly. I'll take my breakfast outside, if none of you mind.
Jin watched her go for a moment before he realized that the other occupants of the table were staring at him. What? He asked.
Heraldin and Geist shared a sidelong glance.
Nothing, said the bard.
The bard may be dressed like a fool, but you play the part better, said Bert.
Geist nodded. Don't encourage him, the bard told the weapons master. I thought Laruna and I resolved things rather well, Jin said.
Yeah, like lantern oil resolves a fire, grumbled Bert.
It could have been worse, said Jin.
Not without getting violent, the kobold shot back.
And there's still plenty of time for that before we ride out, said Heraldin. I don't want to be here if she comes back.
Yeah, come on, said Bert, hopping to his feet. Gorman Katha should be back soon.
Jin mulled over his encounter with the Solomancer as the other adventurers filed out of the tavern. In retrospect, he surmised that Laruna had likely ended the conversation more upset than she started. A part of him wished that he had said things differently. Better. The wizard set those dreams aside in the box in his mind where he stored all such regrets. It was, he reflected, a very large box. Then he tossed his most recent speck of remorse in as well, closed the mental lid, and turned his thoughts to the day ahead of them. There was much work to do.
For starters, they should tear this place down,
Gorm glowered. That's harsh, said Katha.
Gorm nodded at the crumbling exterior of the dwarven embassy.
It's just hard to see the ancestral kingdoms reduced to this.
The old kingdom's delegation had set up their embassy in the remnants of a dwarven jeweler's shop, moldering in the shadow of the ridge on the fifth tier. Bleached and weathered wood was nailed over the display windows, and tattered banners hung from the second-story windows. There was little indication that it was the embassy at all, save for a small sign and a pair of dwarven guards standing stoically at the door.
It does look, a bit modest, said Katha.
More like it has low self-esteem, said Laruna.
It's a thrice-cursed disgrace is what it is, said Gorm, as the three heroes walked toward the decrepit building.
The well-armed dwarves eyed Gorm and his two companions as they approached. The older of the pair, a warrior with a snowy beard spilling from beneath his full helm, pointed at Gorm and made it sound like he was struggling to swallow an enraged owlvarine.
Was that dwarven? Laruna whispered.
Far as I can tell, he's got quite an accent, said Gorm.
He waved a hand to hail the guards.
Ho there!
The younger guard was a stout lad with thick braids in his beard and a thicker brogue in his speech.
"What business do you have with a sheet of Cadden art?"
Gorm stepped squarely in front of the two guards.
"I'm seeking an audience with His Majesty to discuss matters of import." "You have a writ of royal invite, do you?"
said the guard.
"Not as much, no," said Gorm. "Nasty for the horse and without His Majesty's writ."
The older guard was only marginally easier to understand when he used the imperial tongue.
"And how do we get a royal invite?" asked Caitha.
"Not bringing a leaden elf and a she-mage with you would be a good start," chuckled the younger guard.
His elder snorted at the jest.
"Only Her Magister or der court can give a royal invite, curse."
"But if the king doesn't know we want an invite, how would he send one?" said Laruna.
"You'd have to talk to him or his court," said the younger guard.
"But we can't without an invite," said the Solomancer.
The guards looked at each other and shrugged.
"It's a very secure system," said the younger of the two.
Long careers in the Heroes Guild had prepared Gorm and Caitha for such bureaucracy.
"Well, that's a shame," Gorm said loudly. "We're old friends of King Johan, hoping to help King Forder with his financial troubles. But if and he's too busy, we'd best be on our way."
The old guard nodded.
"A wise course of action.
The only one available, it seems." Despite his proclamation of surrender, Gorm didn't step away. The bait was set, and now all someone needed to do was bend the rules enough to take it. The embassy door cracked open, and there was a harsh whisper in Dwarven. Someone yanked the guards to the door and into an animated, if muted, debate.
"How'd you know that would work?" asked Caitha.
Gorm shrugged.
"To hear the town criers tell it, King Forder is the only one in the Freedlands in a worse state than us."
The two guards slunk back to their posts, staring askance at the ground.
"It seems His Majesty's court wishes to extend you a verbal writ of invitation," said the younger dwarf. "Well, let's not keep His Majesty waiting," said Gorm.
They were ushered into a musty antechamber, still save for thick motes of dust wafting through the air. A dwarven clerk in a worn suit greeted the adventurers with a stoic nod. He ushered them into a barren conference room at the back of the embassy, featuring a round table and a poster with a woodcut of a saber-toothed dire cat dangling from a rope over a spiked pit. The caption below the picture read, "Hang in there." Gorm went to take a seat at the table, but found that there weren't any.
"It's a bit sparse," said Caitha, as she and Laruna filed into the room behind him.
"Certainly not what I expected," agreed Laruna.
"I'm going to stick with a disgrace, if it's all the same to ye," said Gorm. "I'm afraid it is all we can afford at the moment," said a voice from the doorway.
Gorm turned to see a graying dwarf in silver chainmail robes standing in the doorway, a gaggle of dour advisers huddled behind him. A thin circlet set atop his head marked him as Forder Hvarthson, King of Cadden Alt, eldest elder and most revered ancestor of the old dwarven kingdoms. Gorm and the women immediately dropped to their knee.
"Your Majesty, enough of that. We've already dispensed with too many formalities for ceremony to matter now."
The king waved them to stand as he stamped over to the head of the conference table.
"A bow means little when it follows an insult to our embassy." "I was just remarking that it ain't worthy of our people, Majesty," said Gorm, feeling a bit of sweat pool on his brow. "Of course it isn't," said the king, over the rumbles of the ancestors and fathers tromping into the room behind him. "We used to have a fine palace up by the pinnacle, but we had to liquidate it. It's a sun-blasted luxury hotel now."
"You sold the embassy?" exclaimed Laruna, forgetting herself.
Gorm shot her a dark glance.
"I've sold just about every bloody thing my people can't eat by now, and they're still starving," snapped the king. "If it were any other way, I'd be in the blessed depths instead of taking audience with whatever gangi drifts in off the street. And in that vein, what do you know of King Johan's plans?"
King Forder's face said the audience would be short, so Gorm spoke as fast as he could.
"We are just a trio of old heroes, Majesty. My name is Gorm, and I quested with King Johan back before he was the Mighty. He and I have enough history for me to know how he operates." "I know who you are, Pyrebeard. There ain't many dwarves who've adventured with Johan, and the rest of them ain't drifting around Arth like slag in a smelting pot."
Forder grimaced.
"If in times weren't so dire, I'd have your clanless hide hauled off to Johan for the reward. As it is, I'm willing to listen to you first.
Gorm had expected the reaction, and he pressed on quickly.
Your Majesty knows as well as I that Johann wouldn't pay you a penny for me or any other reason when there's so much benefit in leaving the old kingdoms broke. He'll keep Your Majesty and his delegation dangling here until you agree to his demands. Based on what I've heard, I'm guessing he wants to annex the old dwarven kingdoms into the Friedlands.
The king looked unmoved.
And you can guess whatever you like. You're here to provide information, not garner it. I'd suggest you get to it soon.
What ye need is a way to gain leverage over Johann, and I know how you can get that, if the Heroes Guild of the Old Dwarven Kingdoms is still intact.
It still exists, said King Forder, though I wouldn't say much beyond that for it.
Many of our heroes have abandoned us to sign on with the Friedlands, said one of the ancestors seated near Forder.
A pin on the lapel of his suit bore the crest of Sword and Sorcery. Gorm surmised that he was the guildmaster of the Old Dwarven Kingdom's branch of the guild.
Better work, they say, and a more favorable tax situation.
The king rolled his eyes.
Corgan, I've heard all I can stomach about the taxes.
Apologies, Majesty. To answer the question, the guild stands, but 'tis weak in numbers.
All it needs is to stand, said Gorm.
What you need is heroes from the Old Dwarven Kingdom to take down the army of Dotar Ermion. Are you mad, boy? Barked Corgan. We just told you.
Let him speak.
The king silenced the guildmaster with a gesture, his eyes never leaving Gorm's.
Most tales of the Pyrebeard involve mad plans, and a surprising number of them actually worked. But beyond the obvious difficulty with slaying a lich, I don't see what leverage it gives me.
Pardon me for bringing them up again, Majesty, but it's the taxes, said Gorm. If an old kingdom heroes kill Dotar and his minions, it's the old kingdom that gets the lion's share of the taxes off the loot.
Especially if you're fulfilling the Ruskin quest, and not the new one the Friedlands spun up when Dotar marched on Highwatch, said Laruna. That would cut Andorin's share of the loot down to zero, said Caitha.
And you can bet Johann's counting on the revenue from Dotar's hoard to rebuild what the Lich has already destroyed.
The king shook his head.
I thought you said you'd worked with Johann before. He would never let our heroes leave the Friedland with all that treasure.
Gorm tapped the side of his nose.
Aye, but he wouldn't be too keen on starting a war with the old kingdoms either. All the clan homes in the Friedlands would revolt, and there'd be dwarves rioting in every city-state.
It'd be much better for him to come to the table with you and negotiate a solution, said Caitha. Where you'd have some leverage, said Laruna.
King Forder nodded, staring at the wall. Eventually he gave one curt nod.
It's a fine idea and a happy thought, but as Corrigan said, we've not a party of heroes qualified to do it.
I ain't sure any party could do it, said Corrigan. You'd need an army of heroes.
Exactly, said Gorm. If you conscript an army into the guild, all as rank one heroes, you might have enough.
And where am I to find such conscripts, both soldiers and heroes?
Chimed in another of the king's advisers. The bars and medals on his chainmail robes marked him as the High Commander of Cadan Alt. Corgan scowled at his colleague.
Anyone who can swing a stick at a rat can be a rank one warrior, Harrick.
Harrick snorted.
Anyone who can swing a stick at a rat is already in my rosters, and I'd still want three times as many dwarves as I have to take on the armies of the Lich.
So could it work? Asked the king.
The guildmaster and the commander shuffled and harumphed noncommittally, but eventually the ancestors conceded the point.
You'd need high-ranking heroes to take down yon lich, but they might be able to with an army taking down the zombies and skeletons, said Corgan.
Forder turned back to Gorm.
It is an interesting plan, but do you know where I can triple the size of my armies?
The king was leaning forward over the table, an eager gleam in his eyes. Gorm took a deep breath.
I can, Majesty, but it'd involve you taking on some new citizens for conscripts, and they wouldn't be dwarves in the strictest sense.
The assembled ancestors and fathers harumphed and shouted protests, but Forder Hvarthson raised a hand to silence them.
There are humans and gnomes living in the old kingdoms now, though not as many. There's even a handful of elves. Better they join our kingdom than us being forced to join theirs.
But Shire,
Corgan began.
I will not hear protest on this, said Hvarthson. If it means a way to shave both our kingdom and the Freedlands, it must be done. If you can bring us an army, we will take your humans, gnomes, and elves as citizens.
Gorm bowed his head, if only to hide the sweat beating on his forehead.
Generous and wise, Majesty. But the army we can bring ain't of humans, gnomes, or elves.
The dwarves murmured to one another in confusion.
Then who do you propose to bring to us?
Said Hvarthson.
The Red Horde.
Gorm's words were nearly drowned out by a collective gasp rising from the dwarves. The king stared at his guests with something between wonder and horror.
Ye are mad,
he whispered.
Completely crazy! A monster!
Bert clambered up to the orc's shoulder and grabbed his face for emphasis.
Beneath these cold eyes is an endless sea of bloodlust. Gorst of the Broke Tooth puts down a lightling village before he breaks fast every morning, and that is just for exercise.
The gnoll and the orc on the opposite side of the table glanced at each other. They wore mismatched armor of dark leather and tarnished metal, and both had crimson patches stitched on their left shoulders, the mark of the Red Horde.
I don't know,
the orcish recruiter spoke Shadow Tongue with the guttural accent of the Pinefells.
Why would we only hear of his deeds now?
Maybe you should pay better attention, said Bert. Down in Dalen, there isn't a lightling that doesn't fear Gorst. Right, Gorst?
The large orc nodded. Gorst was clad in black leather armor, with a hooded cape and a bright red scarf around his neck.
Why does he not talk?
Yipped the gnoll.
He can barely hold back all his murderous rage, said Bert. Even now, it's all he can do to sit in this stinking pink-skinned tavern without killing all the lightlings. If he even let one word out, it might all start coming to a head, and then he's on a killing spree in the River Downs. If you say as much, said the gnoll with obvious doubt. And who are you again?
Me? I'm his agent.
Bert jabbed a thumb at his chest.
We specifically said that recruiters need not apply on the poster,
snarled the gnoll. Bert felt his hackles rise.
Did I say recruiter? I am representing top talent here, and if you want top talent, you go through me.
He sits very still and is very quiet for top talent,
smirked the orc. He poked Gorst in the chest, or rather he reached out to poke Gorst in the chest.
Mistake,
muttered Bert. Regardless of his shape, Gorst, or Geist, or whatever he went by, was still a weapons master. The doppelganger grabbed the orc's wrist and wrenched his arm around with a sickening crunch. The orc screamed, but Gorst silenced him with a series of quick jabs to the face before he heaved the stunned warrior across the room into a pile of barrels. The patrons sitting closest to the barrels scooted their seats away from the destruction, but otherwise the tavern's few occupants remained unmoved. One didn't drink in the River Downs without expecting a bar brawl or three. Bert turned back to the gnoll.
See? Murderous rage, he said.
The gnoll nodded quickly.
It is so. He has my vote. Gabrang?
The wreckage of the barrels shifted. A shaking green fist emerged and extended its thumb upward.
Aha! Then it is settled.
The gnoll recruiter extended a small clipboard to Gorst.
Welcome to the Red Horde, warrior. Fill this out and come with us. You're not going to regret this.
Bert's eyes were on a pair of figures huddled by a table across the bar. One wore a wide-brimmed hat, and the other a set of tattered gray robes. Jin caught his eye and gave him a small nod. The spell was set.
And are you ready to depart now?
Asked the gnoll. Bert grinned.
No time like the present.
Because tomorrow I'll be gone, said Poldo.
Red Squirrel perched on the edge of the bar, nursing a thimble of grog. The beverage splashed a little as the wood gnome waved his hands in the air and chittered at the Scribkin. Poldo couldn't make out his words, but he knew his assistant well enough to guess the sentiment.
I don't like it either, but I must leave the city.
Poldo used the tip of his finger to pat the despondent employee on the back. The tiny man chirruped a single syllable.
Because soon the Lich will arrive, and then there will be no leaving the city. It's going to be hard enough without all these refugees pressing in.
Red Squirrel looked like he was going to say something else, but Poldo cut him off.
And I know that if Andoran falls, nowhere on Arth is safe from the undead. but that's not the point.
The wood gnome shook a hand in the air and loosed a frustrated squeak.
The point is that Benny Hookhand is in this city, or at least his organization is, and from what I've learned of them, I'd have a better chance with the undead.
Poldo drained the last of his halfling brandy. He slapped two Gilton onto the bar next to his empty glass.
Now I need to rely on you to keep track of my movements and keep me connected to the businesses. It'll be hazard pay and a travel stipend for anyone making the journey. Can you do that?
The wood gnome chirruped.
Overtime on weekends only.
A sly squeak.
In this economy? Come now, things are tight,
Poldo protested. A more insistent chitter.
It is that bad, said Poldo. I'd be surprised if we haven't lost another bank by the end of the week.
Someone further down the bar must have overheard Poldo, as a sob rang out in the quiet of the tavern. Most of the other traders and brokers crowded into the common room were too traumatized to react. They stared at nothing and sipped their drinks in silent misery. Red Squirrel shook his head and looked back to his grog, chittering a presumably unflattering remark. But Poldo could see that he had won.
Thank you, my friend, said Poldo. I'll rendezvous with the team later tonight at the city gate.
The domovoy squeaked a question and pantomimed a hook for one of his hands. He drew the other hand across his throat, stuck his tiny tongue out, and went cross-eyed. Poldo shook his head sadly as he hopped off the stool.
Oh, I heard that rumor as well. And I hope it's true, he said. But you don't stay in the business as long as I have by taking bad risks, and I know better than to bet against Benny Hookhand.
Well, well, what are the odds?
Gerald Flynn muttered to himself as he examined the broken arrow protruding from the river house's weather-worn wall. The shaft was perfectly cylindrical and smooth, the fletching precisely spaced. Either it was the work of a master fletcher, or it was made by magic such as that held in the poor man's quiver. And now that he looked closer, he could see silver wisps trailing from the shaft as the magical arrow slowly dissipated. It would completely dissolve within a few days. He knew that Caitha of House Tyriath wasn't the only hero to have a poor man's quiver. Then again, how many adventurers who could afford such distinctive ammunition were also traveling with a solomancer capable of blasting half of a wall to charred rubble, and someone wielding an axe to brutal effect on the inner doorway? Flynn rubbed the stub beneath his metallic claw as he thought about the axe that took his own hand. This was Gorm Ingerson's work. He could feel it in his bones. The dwarven outcast's return to Andoran was a boon to Mr. Flynn. The assassin's job wasn't finished, a point his employer had been emphasizing lately by having gift baskets of fruits and baked goods delivered to Flynn's residence. There was nothing malicious amongst the basket's contents, save perhaps for cookies with raisins in them, and the attached notes from the king were always cordial and pleasant. The message wasn't about the actual contents of the baskets. It was the manner in which they showed up just inside Flynn's doorway once every few days, with a note personally penned by King Johan. No matter where the Tinderkin was hiding, no matter how carefully he covered his tracks, he'd inevitably find a fruit basket sitting on the border of his defenses, broadcasting a threat, loud and clear. Johan was taking a personal interest in his work. Johan could find him. Johan's people could reach him. And oh, by the way, how is that job with Gorm Ingerson coming? Flynn flexed his claws. The job was going a little better now that there were clear signs the dwarf was back in the city. Word on the street was that Barty Fisser had skipped town a couple of weeks back with a new name and new face, and the latter was involuntary. More recently, an informant had seen the dwarf and some of his party down at the River Otter, and now there were rumors that the berserker had taken on Benny Hookhand in the River Downs. Yet knowing where your enemy has been, however, is not nearly as valuable as knowing where he will go next. Flynn turned his attention to searching the rubble for signs of Ingerson's plans. He was disappointed. Between the bannermen and the Hookhand's thugs, the crime scene had been cleared of any valuable evidence. More specifically, it had been cleared of any evidence that would be worth more than a few coppers at the local pawn shop. Aside from the damage to the building and a splintered arrow here and there were few clues to go on.
It struck Flynn that he should check the riverbanks below the ruined shack. This was a new sensation, the Tinderkin reflected as he climbed down the overgrown stone steps to the shore. He'd been struck by thoughts before, but never with the strange force that had just planted the idea in his skull. It was like a slap that bypassed the face to strike the brain directly. He ducked down and surveyed the muddy banks obscured in the shadows beneath the creaking ruin. There wasn't anything but river grass and muck.
Check by the third pylon.
A chill ran down Flynn's spine. The last thought had definitely not been his own, but a quick glance at the rotting support closest to the water revealed the glint of dark metal. He crept closer. A metal hook was half submerged in the mud and river grass.
Pick it up.
I think not. Flynn smiled at the flash of displeasure that flared in his mind. I'm quite familiar with the dangers of touching enchanted weapons, let alone the famous Benny Hookhand.
Pick me up!
Benny snarled in Flynn's mind. Oh, I'm not going to wield you, said Flynn, but I might be able to help you in exchange for information.
What information?
Flynn could feel the blade's suspicion.
Just some questions about the party that attacked your building here, said Flynn. You answer them, and I'll return you to your thugs.
Pick me up!
It was less a suggestion now, and more of an attempt to force Flynn to bend to the weapon's will. I could spend a considerable amount of time detailing the rigorous training that I've endured to protect my mind from such invasion, said Flynn. Alas, I'm in a hurry, as is my client, so if you're not interested in my proposal...
Wait!
Flynn grinned.
Yes?
How can you take me anywhere if you won't pick me up?
Oh, I'll lift you from the muck, just with the necessary precautions.
Slowly, carefully, Flynn reached down with his enchanted prosthetic. With Benny Hookhand's iron handle clutched in the metallic talons, the weapon was safely held a few inches away from Flynn's skin. He regarded the muddy hook at arm's length.
So, do we have a deal?
In place of a response, the iron bands that comprised Benny's handle suddenly unwound themselves with the swift fluidity of serpents. They flexed as they wove between the mechanical fingers of Flynn's prosthetic, dismantling the silver claw as they wound down to drive their spikes into the stub at the end of the gnome's arm. The scream died in Gerald Flynn's mouth as the part of him that was Gerald Flynn was pulled down, back and away from his own eyes, until he was a passenger in his own body. Benny Hookhand cracked his new neck and worked his jaw experimentally.
Yeah. I don't make deals, he said.